Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour about things, you'll go frickin' nuts. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny, slave South Pacific. It's frickin' gorgeous down here. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which, according to the Prime Minister John Key, is good for the economy. Now, today we have a very special guest, Mr. John Ansell from Treatygate, and we're having some problem with his connections, as was expected. And so what I'm going to do is attempt to grab his phone number and chuck it in for AFR so we can connect him up via the phone as well. And I've only have a cell phone number for See, this is the frustrating thing.
You're looking
right,
for me, Vinny?
John. Yeah. You're there now for maybe a minute or two, John. Would you be able to quickly flick me your landline number there so we can connect you on that, just in case your Skype drops out again, because this is the fourth or fifth time it's dropped out already and we haven't even started the show yet.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Landline is 499-8877.
04-499-8877. 499-8877. Yeah, so that's 644. Right, I got it. So don't worry, we'll get you connected on that one shortly.
Wellington.
Yeah. Don't worry, man. We got it all sorted. And you just gave everybody who's listening your phone number. So let's hope you don't get a rash of angry calls. And maybe we'll try and edit that out of the archives. Eh? So while we're getting John connected, AFR, can you hear me, by the way? Are you connecting him? Because I'm not sure 100% what's going on because he's dropped off again. I hate this. Really hate this when you have these kind of technical difficulties. Skype's normally really, really good. Just sweet as, no problem. It works. And you got high audio quality. You can do the video and all of that kind of stuff. And on occasions, you get massively, massively technically fracked out. It's like really nasty. Okay, now, speaking of Treatygate, and this is what John's going to be on here today. By the way, AFR, what the frack are you doing? Are we going to connect, John, or what? Are you even there? Are you having water? Are you going to the bathroom? You taking a WikiLeak? What's going on here? Come on, bro. Help me out a little here. He's talking about Treaty Gate. Now, for those of you in the rest of the world who don't know what Treaty Gate is, we are a crown colony, a little country here. And on top of that, the thing that's happened, at least according to my research and experience, talking with a number of Māori elders and so on and so forth, is that the founding document of this country, the Treaty of Waitangi, has not been adhered to, and indeed has been manipulated and a source of revenue for what some kaumātua told me called the brown elite, as it were. Okay, you know how there's an elite, you know, like the evil scumbaggery individuals. You know, well, there's sections of elites in every culture and every society. Okay, now, John, I believe we've got you on the phone now. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm on the phone. I'm also seeing myself on the video. I can see you. I don't know if this is going to last, but anyway, yeah. We're on the phone.
All right, excellent, excellent. Okay, well, I've just been talking about the sort of the treaty and how a lot of founding documents don't get followed in any way to the T, and how now currently there's varying forms of elites that are running the globe, including a quote unquote brown elite, which a kaumātua Māori elders were telling me about. That are now ruling the kind of treaty grievance industry and lining their own pockets with the money that would ordinarily go to the average Māori, who are currently miraculously overrepresented in poverty statistics and so on and so forth. But anyway, let's get on to you and yourself and what it is you do. Could you give a brief background? Because a lot of people listening wouldn't know your kind of background, and we hung out a little bit. And you told me a bit about your advertising past, and I thought it was remarkably interesting, and it gives a lot of depth to your character when people know.
Character, advertising. You don't hear those two words in the same sentence very often.
Not very often at all, but you are pretty exceptional.
Well, Vinny, I started, I guess, as an advertising copywriter. I got involved with the Labor Party in 87, did a campaign for them on the radio, another one in 90 and 93, but I became increasingly disenchanted with the socialists, I guess, and refused to work for them after that. I saw Don Brash coming up for the National Party in 2003, when he started, I think, and put my hand up to do that campaign. And that campaign became quite well known. It was a series of billboards with red on the left and blue on the right. The red represented the Labor Party, and it had the Prime Minister's face. And the blue represented the National Party, the right-wing party, for your American listeners who wear the colours the other way around. But and the most remembered of those billboards, which did make a big difference to them, although they didn't quite win, was one called Iwi Kiwi. And Iwi, for your overseas listeners, means tribe, means Maori tribe. Kiwi is the, you know, name for New Zealanders. So the point then was that the beaches, the word beaches was at the top. Beaches, Iwi Kiwi, Iwi, the Labor Party were standing for Iwi, the tribes and the National Party were standing for all New Zealanders, including Iwi. Well, that's how we explained it. But this, of course, brought accusations of racism. Any time you stand up on this issue in New Zealand, you are called a racist if you don't happen to believe that the country should be surrendered to the part descendants of the rebels who rose up against the state in the 1860s. These are those same families. They're just a minority of Maori. Anyway, I saw this increasingly happening, and I, you know, when I want someone to solve my problems, I usually mean someone else, when someone should stand up and say something. On this particular issue, I thought, well, perhaps that someone might be me, given my association with that issue through the Iwi Kiwi billboard. So I started to study the history to see whether my forefathers were the you know, merciless brutes, the evil colonizers that they've been made out to be in our schools and universities and on our media and anywhere you care to look. And I found that, in fact, the opposite was the case. And so what we are party to, really, for the last 40 years is a con job. I can only call it Treaty Gate because that's what you call scandals. I'd rather be more original. But it's a con job on a misrepresentation of New Zealand history, which makes out that the Maori chiefs were sitting in this sort of South Pacific paradise sunning themselves when the evil British came in and brutalized them. And you get people saying, I mean, it's the big lie principle. It's the Hitler big lie principle. Don't just tell a small lie because people expect politicians to tell small lies. If you want to win, you tell a big lie. So you get people like the Maori Party co-leader Tariana Turia saying that there was a Holocaust in Taranaki, the province of Taranaki. Well, in fact, there were three. The first was the invasion by the Waikato people in 1831, who holocausted a third of the Taranaki, enslaved another third, and another third fled to Wellington. Of that third that fled, 900 hijacked a ship to the Chatham Islands out to the west and holocausted. That really was a holocaust of the Moriori people. About 1,500 of them ended up dying, which was virtually all of them. There were about 1,600. About 1,500 ended up dead. That was a real genocide, a real holocaust, but we're not supposed to talk about that. So I do. I say that the worst thing that the British were supposed to have done in Taranaki was the invasion of Parihaka, which was a village which was set up illegally on land which had been confiscated rightly for the rebellion, for the earlier rebellion. And this village was set up, and the Crown had been patiently asking Te Whiti, who was the self-proclaimed Jesus of Parihaka.
Okay, we seem to have lost John again.
Marshaled horse and went in. Apart from one boy who had his foot stood on by accident by a trooper's horse, nobody died. And so I say, what was the death toll at Parihaka in Taranaki? Zero. What was the death toll in the Chatham Islands of the invasion by Taranaki? 1,572. You point that out to the New Zealand media or in these various constitution debates, in quotes, that we've been having, all one-sided, and you're called a racist. Have I explained myself clearly as to where I've come from? I've gone on
okay.
a bit, Vinny, but...
So basically, big-time ad man actually helped one of the... In fact, both sides of the political stripe come to power... And got disillusioned with both sides of the political strife.
Oh, yeah.
And then for telling the truth, now you get endlessly demonized and called a racist. Is that about right?
All of our parties are, they're both left-wing parties, really. I mean, the Labour Party in the 80s was a right-wing party. This is the equivalent of the Democrats, was a right-wing party implementing a form of Thatcherism or Reaganomics called Rogeronomics here after Roger Douglas. So I was kind of comfortable with that. Then they became progressively reverted to type, and along came Helen Clark, so I didn't like the sound of her. She's now running the UN in part. And she was put there by the so-called right-wing prime minister we have now, John Key, who's really a centrist. A centrist is someone who charts a comfortable path between right and wrong. Well, on this issue, he's dead wrong. He's worse than Helen Clark. He's giving away the country in spades. I mean, what sort of country surrenders itself, not from a position of weakness, not to save its beaten population from unspeakable agonies, not in the face of a conquering horde, but from a position of strength? What sort of country does that? And what sort of country pays reparations? Where do the victors in a war of rebellion, the people who put down the rebellion, Where else in the world do their great-grandchildren pay reparations to the great-grandchildren of the defeated rebels? But that's what happens here down under.
It sounds like, hold on a second, if I was a king, per se, and I were to loan a peasant a shockingly large amount of cash, and then when that peasant dies, I then hold that debt over his children and every subsequent generation of his family. Is that sort of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What did we? What have you and I done wrong, Vinny? I mean, I bailed up a guy. In fact, he came to see me. A fellow called Dr. Carwin Jones. Dr. Carwin Jones Boyle, who claims to be Maori. He took issue with the fact that I'd called him a make-believe Maori on my blog because he's basically Welsh. He denies that. And I said, it's an extraordinary coincidence that your father decided to call you Carwin, which is the same name as the Welsh Prime Minister, I understand. But he, you know, I said to him, Carwin, why do I owe you money? You are apparently, you say on your website, you're of Ngāti Kahungunu and Te Aitanga a Mahaki descent. Nothing about Ngāti Cardiff or anywhere like that. You say that you're Māori, and you say that I have to pay, my kids have to pay you and your kids money. Why? And he says, well, for example, my grandmother was prevented from speaking Māori at school. I said, and therefore she was prevented from teaching her kids Māori and their kids Māori, and I therefore can't, you know, don't know Māori to teach my kids, although they're in a full immersion Māori school, and how they'll emerge with any knowledge of the language of the world, I don't know. But anyway, this man who is a doctor thinks that is justification for paying him money. I said, look, I happen to be in a family outnumbered by Taiwanese. My wife is Taiwanese. My stepson, didn't speak Chinese at school either, but she made damn sure that he spoke it at home because she spoke it to him. He ended up with the English prize at a school, by the way, and ducks. But, you know, this is what happens, that the immigrants come in and do really well. The locals just moan about how little privilege they have. In fact, everybody's bending over backwards to indulge them endlessly. You know, it's just this sense of entitlement. It's gone too far. I think we probably all agree that certain injustices occurred here and there, but they've been well and truly compensated for, sometimes four or five times in the case of the Ngāi-Tahu tribe. The Ngāi-Tahu tribe were 2,000 strong in the South Island, 2,000 strong in 1840, and have now been given $170 million with more to come.
Well, hold on, John, we're going to have to stop you right there. Not because it's too controversial, but because we're coming to break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam. Waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, live from New Zealand, governed by our fabulous what's his name? Federal Reserve employee, former John Key, derivatives trader, John Key, sell us out to the UN and destroy the country basically by getting it into massive astronomical quantities of debt, John Key. Yeah, that's what this country is all about. Now, if you have a prime minister who's an international banker, you can be rest assured that pretty much everything in your country will get fracked up sooner or later. My very special guest is John Ansell. And John, what's your website again? Is it treatygate.wordpress.com?
Treatygate.org.com, yeah. Treatygate.org.nz. Treatygate.org.nz. It is, in fact, a WordPress site, but treatygate.org.nz.
Yep. Sorry. You try and...
We just put up the topical... Events of the day. Yesterday, what was it? Omaru North School. Now, Omaru is a town in the South Island. The only thing it's really known for is its beautiful Victorian architecture built out of this white stone which sculptors use to make beautiful sculptures all around the place, sculptures. And they make this have this beautiful stone down there and these beautiful buildings, including basilicas and all sorts.
John, hold on one second. Are you able to press the little microphone mute button on your Skype there? We're getting some form of an echo.
Little mute button.
It'll look like a miniature microphone sort of on your Skype there, and if you just click that, it'll turn off your microphone so that you just you just talk.
Okay.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Done. Yeah, so in Oamaru there, the local school, Oamaru North School, has they sent their teachers on a staff training day, professional development. It was, in fact, a Treaty of Waitangi brainwashing session. And they came away full of the joys of, you know, Maori superiority, and they unilaterally decided that the children would be instructed to identify Oamaru not with the stone architecture, the lovely buildings that had been the symbol of the town for the last 150 years, but with some primitive rock drawings, Maori rock drawings, 42 kilometres out of town in a place called Duntroon. The syllabus, the social studies syllabus, now requires the children to regard as the symbol of Oamaru some rock drawings half an hour out of town, and not the buildings that they see all around them, which everybody else associates with Oamaru. It's just one small example of the Maorification of everything. That was yesterday's example.
Now, there was also a element, we were talking about psychopaths on a show a couple of days ago, and what was very interesting is we got into the discussion of race and different groups, and what was interesting is that the way that you divide people is you force one group of people to tolerate another group of people. They'd automatically tolerate them, but because they're forced to tolerate them, they start to hate them. Isn't that interesting?
Well, I'm afraid that is what's happening here. I'm obviously, as somebody fronting this issue, I am assumed to hate Maori deeply. It doesn't go with my brand that I should actually have Maori friends or that actually like some Maori. But that's true of me, and it's true of others, that we do. That's why this is such an uncomfortable issue. You know, we're potentially offending people we've been to school with, people we work with, people we know and like, and the country is being polarized, not because of Maori, but because of a minority of this minority. Maori in New Zealand are supposed to be 15%. There's so much intermarriage now, and that's another interesting factor for people that are supposed to have been so brutalized or so... Or hate the Pākehā so much. There's been an awful lot of intermarriage. There are no full-blooded Maori left, or very few. But, you know, this is about a minority, and I would be very, very happy if, as a result of this campaign, the what I call achiever Maori, the people that live with achiever values like everybody else, rise up and tell the grievers, this minority who are after all the money, that they don't speak for them. Now, I'm very, very pleased that my next meeting in Hamilton, which is our fourth largest city, the meeting has been organised by Tim Wickeriffery, a Maori libertarian, Christian Maori libertarian, probably the only one. But he, you know, he is so strong on this issue, and I'm hoping that others will be inspired by him, and so that it won't be this sort of lone European who is doing all this stuff. There will be a large body of Maori who take the issue on themselves.
Now, here's the other thing. If you don't like what somebody's saying, let's say, for example, you're brainwashed and somebody comes out to you with a very, very hard truth with hard facts, and it really corrupts their entire systemized education system. The first thing that they do is they start name-calling. Right, it's designed to ridicule and to get people to switch off. I've heard a number of interviews with you. You kept getting cut off. You kept getting called names. You keep having people call up and talk about the exact same thing over and over again. And it's like people just aren't willing to listen. It's like they can't hear it because they have purposefully blocked themselves off from facts and evidence.
Facts are an impediment. Facts in New Zealand are regarded as the ultimate inconvenient truths. They really are things to be avoided. Facts like the Moriori invasion and so many other things. The truth of the Treaty of Waitangi, the fact that the real English draft was found in 1989, but has been covered up by the state. And that particular draft makes it clear that the treaty was with all the people of New Zealand, not just Maori. You know, the fact that the principles of the treaty, which were invented in 1989 also, I call it the Treaty of Wellington by Geoffrey Palmer, a Prime Minister at the time, we're supposed to abide by the principles of the treaty. He made them up. They don't occur anywhere in the actual treaty. They're his sort of fantasy of what he would have liked the actual treaty to be. Over and over again, facts are just set aside in favour of the prevailing fantasy. And a lot of people just can't get around this idea, can't get their head around the idea, because they've been brainwashed for 40 years to believe one truth, that somebody could be getting up and saying such supposedly divisive things. Now, I urge people to recognise a great difference between criticism and racism. What I'm into is criticism. But look, even if I was racist to my little cotton socks, it wouldn't matter as long as the things I was saying were true. Truth is what matters, isn't it? Not whether you like or dislike people or not. It wouldn't matter if I hated every last Maori person. What would matter is whether what I'm saying is the truth. But that is, it's taking a while for people for the penny to drop on that. They say, oh, well, he's a racist because he's coming out with these things. He's a racist, therefore nothing he says can be listened to. Now, that's just fundamentally illogical, isn't it? First of all, I'm not racist, but second of all, if I was, it wouldn't matter either.
Well, they're suffering cognitive dissonance. They've had a reality created for them, and they've structured their life around that reality. And what you're doing is you're pulling the support strut directly out of that building that they've closed themselves in on. And, of course, you're the one who's demolished their house. You're a bad person. You're an evil, evil man, John Antle.
Indeed I am. Indeed I am. I shall put my white hat on. But look, this is something that all of the New Zealand elites are doing. Now, you view this from a broader, more global perspective. I'm not an expert on Agenda 21 and all the UN stuff, but I can certainly see how this might well fit in. Because here, it's the political elite, this right-wing Prime Minister who campaigned on abolishing the separate Maori seats. It's our little form of apartheid that we've had since 1876. Campaigned on that and then got in and became the champion for Maori sovereignty by doing an unnecessary coalition deal with the Maori Party. He was looking ahead. I've worked for this man. I couldn't do it. I couldn't take my pay. So I left because I realised he is not interested in New Zealand at all. He is interested in John Key first, the National Party second. Anything else is irrelevant. So he did this deal, which nobody wanted. He didn't even need it to get the majority, but he did it because he thought he was looking ahead to the next election and thought, oh, as things close up between us and Labour, we might need some favours from the Maori Party, so we'll give them everything they want. And so they have. And so now abolishing the Maori seats are off the agenda. We'll probably have more soon after the Maori electoral roll campaign, because Maori here get the chance to decide whether they want to go on the general roll or the Maori roll, and more are being urged to go on the Maori roll. And he's now set up a constitutional review.
Here's another element. I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's something that reminded me. I was listening to you on the radio with John Tamahiri and Willie Jackson, and I called in, but the show ended before I was able to go to me as a caller, and I had two simple questions. Willie Jackson, how much money has been taken from treaty claims just in general? And more, and specifically, just a supplementary to that one, how much of that has filtered down to the ordinary Maori? And Willie Jackson, what kind of car do you drive?
Willie Jackson drives a very flash SUV.
He drives a Dodge Ram.
I went up to Waitangi. I didn't know what was going to happen there. I thought I might have got shot. But I saw him at Waitangi, which is the place where we celebrate our supposedly our National Day. And he was driving a very flash SUV, as was Tamahiri. He drives his boy to King's College in the SUV. King's College is probably our flashiest school in Auckland. He claims that the money isn't getting through. I think it's certainly getting through to Willie and to Tamahiri. I was told, I don't know whether it's true, but May Chen, who is probably no friend of mine, was talking in a race debate the other day and saying that John Tamahiri's got $50 million out of this. Now, that's unconfirmed, but look, you wouldn't bet against it. These guys at the top are coining it. The people down the bottom, the stats are just as bad. And they say they use it to justify further money. Hone Harawira said to me, and Hone Harawira is the head of the Mana Party, Mana meaning sort of status in Māoridom. Now, he said to me, oh, you know, it's all very well you talking about a colourblind state and all this, but, you know, our people remain at the bottom. Well, look, if they choose not to accept their privileges, what are we to do about it? I mean, they get privileges galore in New Zealand. I was told that there were no such thing as Maori privileges, so I produced a scroll and unrolled it on TV, and I said, I'm sorry the printing's so small that you can't read it, but there are just so many privileges to fit in. But they use this excuse of, you know, our people are still at the bottom, so we need more money. I said, well, you know, why so? It's obviously not working. You know, shoveling the money at them is obviously not working. It's obviously getting to you guys and no further. So therefore, we've got to do something different. That rather throws them. That's an inconvenient fact, you see.
See, that's exactly my point. Now, if you are a Māori in general, and I spoke to a bunch of Māori chiefs about this issue, and this is what I was saying but before you came on today, was about the so-called brown elite. The chief told me that back in the 50s, I think, the original kingitanga, the chiefs of the time, were married into by a bunch of other people, and those other people basically took over the interests of the Māori chiefs and the kingitanga and all of that kind of stuff, and ever since then have been taking away everything from their people, right? This is one of the kingitanga himself actually saying this, one of the prime bloodlines of the chiefs saying this. Is he a racist?
Oh, they're the racists, definitely. I mean, I can't use the word that Hone Harawira used to describe Pākehā meaning white people. You know what it is, but it starts with M and it's got an F in it somewhere and a K, but I'm not allowed to say it on your program. But
it rhymes with white mother fracker.
Yes, that's right, fracker, that's right. And, you know, that's the way they talk routinely. These guys are thugs and extortionists. Maori used to have some very, very respectable statesmen. You go into the Maori caucus room at Parliament, where I've been, and there is all these wonderful carvings, and there are these four enormous portraits staring down, and they are Sir Apirana Nata, Sir Maui Pomari, Sir Peter Buck, Te Rangihiro was his Maori name, and Sir James Carroll. And these guys, they thought like me. they had the same idea about Māoridom as we do, that separatism is terrible, that they can do it just like anybody else, but they've got to work together. And that's why my brand that I'm developing is called Together New Zealand. We have some wonderful sports teams in New Zealand that beat the world, you know, the All Blacks, the Silver Ferns, the netball team, and they're multiracial teams, and they work together. Nobody says, I'm not passing the ball to you because you're Māori or you're Pākehā or you're Samoan. It's just all in together to beat the world. And New Zealanders take great pride doing that. Why can't our politicians think like that? You know, why does our country have to be split between races? It's ridiculous.
Well, you know, and another element that I want to get into after the break is just how the concept of welfare and having infinite benefits and entitlements actually destroys societies. It actually stops people from being motivated to do something with their lives in a lot of cases. And this has happened, and the statistics really prove it in the Māori community, and it's very sad for these people of great potential. We'll be right back after the break. John Ansell.
La la la.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live in operatic frequencies. My very special guest is John Ansell. And now, John, welfare. What has welfare done to Māori? It's, as far as I see, it's destroyed them in a lot of ways.
It's created a sense of dependency, which just plays on the existing sense of entitlement which they're being sort of brainwashed with.
And it's not just Māori who get destroyed by welfare.
He was the one who warned that welfare would be the destruction of Māori. That was at the time when it was being created in the 1930s, state.
Sorry, John, who warned that welfare would be the destruction of Māori?
The great Māori statesman, arguably the greatest Māori statesman, Sir Apirana Nata. And he was a real achiever Māori. He was a contemporary of Lord Ernest Rutherford, in a recent survey I saw, the third greatest physicist in world history, after Newton and Einstein. Well, he was a contemporary of Rutherford's at Canterbury University, but he chose, instead of going to Europe with Rutherford, he chose to stay in New Zealand and help his people. And he, despite his mana, his prestige, he could not persuade Māori to not accept the welfare, and that has been the ruin, especially in the 1970s when the welfare state was opened up to young solo mothers, and Māori really, unfortunately, took to that. They actually, there's almost an industry of solo mothers getting pregnant, having children in order to collect the domestic purposes benefit. And midwives report this, that mothers attending the birth, somebody was telling me the other day, and they said to their young daughter, they said, see this young mother, this is what you should be doing, getting pregnant and getting the welfare. And this particular section of Māoridom are quite shameless about that. And that is not to say it's all of them by any means, but there is a large section. So Māori are disproportionately represented in the welfare statistics, overwhelmingly represented in the prison statistics, where half of all crime is committed by 15% of the population, the Māori 15%.
Well, there's also a racial group,
but they only commit crime roughly in proportion to their numbers. But welfare has, there's guys lying around smoking dope, collecting the dole, and there's no almost moral call for them to do otherwise. Now, that is not true in the case of David Rankin. Now, David Rankin is a Ngāpuhi chief who is a capitalist. By God, he comes out with messages like, we should take away the money. He also comes out and says that Māori were not the first people here, that there were people when his ancestor Kupe, he's a direct descendant of Kupe, the first supposed discoverer of New Zealand, and he says there were people here when we got here. So David Rankin is a very controversial figure who the likes of Willie Jackson and John Tamahere despise for telling the truth. And he wants the welfare taken away. He wants people to be more self-reliant, like the warriors of old. You know, they come from a strong warrior culture. I'm not so keen on having more warriors around, but the self-determination part of that is admirable, and that's what some of these Māori elders want. But unfortunately, they're not the noisiest ones. The noisiest ones have their hands out the whole time. And they want the money to go to them. No, it's become a disease. It's killing New Zealand, and it's got to be limited. New Zealanders are compassionate people. We're proud of our social welfare state, arguably the first in the world, I believe, to have a welfare state. But that welfare, instead of being a safety net, as it was when the Labour Prime Minister Michael Joseph Savage established it. Were he alive today, he'd probably vote with the ACT Party, the right-wing party, and he would be horrified at how this safety net has effectively turned into a hammock. It needs to be more of a trampoline. It needs to bounce people back into work, but unfortunately, Māoridom, more than any other section of society, have embraced the hammock.
Well, I have a suspicion that because of the warrior spirit that Māori represent, that they are indeed a danger to any kind of tyrannical government that might take root in this country and perhaps get violent. I mean, back in the day, was that a great fear of the British soldiers, of Māori military abilities and things of that nature?
Well, Māori culture is most famous for various forms of violence. And in the 1820s and 30s, there was another genocide, really the inter-tribal genocide that probably claimed the lives of a third of Māori. Tribes just used to love going to war. They used to love eating human flesh when they won. This is the environment that the British came into. A lot of that violence is still around. It's only four generations since cannibalism. I was told that by a cousin of Hone Harawira. She said, "I can say that, but you can't." I said, "Watch me." Look, there's still a lot of violence in young Maori men. And not just men either, but that's got to be bred out somehow. And in the Uruwera Mountains, we had the situation a few years ago when Tama Iti, Maori separatist, and a gang of his mates were conducting, pretty much setting up a guerrilla army. It's been minimized, of course, through the courts and the media, who seem to be just devoted to minimizing any bad stuff done by Maori. I've seen the police affidavit of their conversations. They were planning urban warfare. Pretty dumb about it, but they got sent to prison. They couldn't convince a jury that they were doing that because the Solicitor General would not allow the police evidence to be shown for some technical reason, hadn't got a permit or something. So they got away with that, and they went to prison for a much shorter term for some lesser crime. But look, that's happening. That is happening, and you know, it is possible that if Maori don't get their own way, there could be some sort of civil war. And that's what people are afraid of. And when you have that looming up as a possibility, you can go two ways. You can go the Neville Chamberlain way or the Winston Churchill way. And I say that we have had appeaser governments who live in fear of such things, and they're basically being bullied into giving these radical, violent Maori everything they want. I'm saying that is not tenable. That is not what you do if you love your country. You stand up to the bully, like Kennedy, if you like Churchill had to do. Nobody wants to fight, but sometimes you have to defend your country. Our national anthem is "God Defend New Zealand." Well, I think he might need some help. But I think these guys know that that it can't last forever. They just can't believe their luck in getting all this stuff. And all the welfare and all the treaty settlements, and they'll be claiming the sun next on the basis that Maui, the legendary Maui, threw a net over the sun to slow down its passage across the sky. Therefore, I would say they invented daylight saving, so they should be able to clip the ticket on a percentage of anything that's grown by the sun. This is the sort of game that's been played. I think Maori respect a challenge. They respect people. I get them saying that they're actually respecting me, even though they're going hammer and tongs and calling me things, but they actually respect someone who stands up. They tell me quietly, says, "We'll keep taking as long as you guys keep giving." I say, "I know, that's right. That's why we've got to stop, because it's ruining our country."
Yeah, I was invited down to the Temple of the Four Winds. It's like a sacred site among Māoridom. It's the first journalist ever to be invited down there, like ever. It's been there for a long, 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 long time. Very honoured. And you know what I noticed about all these elders, bro?
What?
They had frickin' good, great senses of humour, and they were cheeky as frack.
Yeah.
Right.
Look, it's been a great practical joke. They are wonderfully humorous people. And like I can tell you something I haven't revealed on my blog yet, but I was rung the other day by a guy called Alan Titford. Now, Alan Titford has been treated disgracefully by the New Zealand state. He's been kicked off his farm in order to facilitate a Maori, a shonky Maori claim on his land. And he has been hounded and harassed by every organ of state. He's had trumped up charges of violence levelled against him. He's the most meek and mild man. Anyway, he went to Jim Bolger's. And now, Jim Bolger was our Prime Minister from 1990 to 96 or so. And he was a great appeaser of the Maori. Now, Jim Bolger was packing up from his farm in Tikawiti and going to live in Waikanae. So the Tikawiti people had a function for him. Alan Titford thought he'd go along. And so did Coral Wetteri. Now, Coral Wetteri was the Minister of Maori Affairs, Maori MP, and he had the misfortune to plonk himself down next to Alan Titford in the audience, which, and he didn't know Alan, even though he was party to a lot of the harassment. He'd forgotten who Alan was. So Alan overheard Coro Wetteri saying to a young Maori chap next to him, he said, "Oh, that's, see on the stage, that's Jim Bolger. We've had him round our little finger for years. We didn't realise how much they were going to give us." And next thing you know, Jim Bolger is coming up and saying to Coro Wetteri, "Ah, komatua," komatua means chief, elder, "komatua Coro Wetteri, I'm not going to shake your hand, I'm going to give you a big hug." So absolute sycophant, you know. And this is symbolic of how it's been for the last 20-odd years, this bending over backwards to appease. You put a cloak, Dover Samuels MP used to say, he's Maori, used to say, you put a cloak on a Pākehā and he goes weak at the knees.
We're going to break, and we'll be right back with John Ansell. Treatygate.org.nz is the website.